Burmese don't want them back. That's what ethnic cleansing means. So the problem is the Bangladeshis don't want them either.
Myanmar looks to Beijing amid Rohingya crisis. It's Monday, December 4th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're also on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, aid may be drying up for Rohingya refugees. U.S. Defense Secretary heads to Pakistan. Australia defines assisted dying. Growing diamonds, music's Grammy nominees. It's all on today's VOA Asia. The Myanmar government news agency says State Councilor and Foreign Minister Aung San Suu Kyi was in Beijing last week attending a Communist Party high-level meeting and holding bilateral talks with her Chinese counterparts. Her visit comes just days after China's President Xi Jinping and military leaders hosted the commander-in-chief of Myanmar's armed forces. The meeting comes as more than 620,000 Rohingya Muslims have fled across their border to Bangladesh to escape conflict with Myanmar's military. The visit also comes after a list of high-level Western officials, including the Pope and the U.S. Secretary of State, criticizing the Rohingya exodus. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Professor David Steinberg, a former distinguished professor of Asian studies at Georgetown University, and asked him what both countries want from each other.
Myanmar wants a neutral policy, basically. In other words, it's got to get along with all its neighbors. They know there's an India-China rivalry. They don't want to insult either one. They are a member of ASEAN. They have to deal with their other Southeast Asian neighbors. They want good relations with the U.S. and the EU for trade and other reasons, but also as protection against China, if you will. China wants many things. First, they built two pipelines across Myanmar, one for Burmese natural gas, second for crude oil from the Middle East and Africa. And the result of this is a very important relationship that supplies energy needs to China. Number two, China has wanted in the past electric energy, and so they've tried to build dams. They built some and were rebuffed on one of the major dams in that area. Number three, they want access to the Indian Ocean and the Bay of Bengal. And they have trying to develop the port of Jokpu, the terminus of these pipelines, into an economic zone. And that is an ongoing major project of the Chinese. The Chinese have what has been called the string of pearls in the Indian Ocean. These are not bases, but they are facilities, port facilities, that the Chinese can use to try and protect their shipping. One is at Gwadar in Pakistan, Hambantota in Sri Lanka, Chittagong in Bangladesh, and Jokpu in Myanmar. These are important for the Chinese because the Chinese want to develop a blue water navy. And, of course, India is very concerned about this, as you can imagine.
What about Aung San Suu Kyi? Is she caught between a rock and a hard place here?
Yes. She has said, "I don't want to be a democratic icon." That's a quote from her. I'm a politician, she said. She is, however, has been a democratic icon to the world, but she's not a very good politician because she controls, her party controls the legislature, and they can appoint ministers. But when you look at the real power structure in that society, it is controlled by the military.
At the meeting in Beijing on Friday, much talk was made of an idea from the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang saying that China should take over the repatriation of the Rohingya back to Myanmar. Can they do that? Do you think that's possible?
No, that's not possible. First of all, you've got a problem. If there is indeed ethnic cleansing, and I think that's true, the Burmese don't want them back. That's what ethnic cleansing means. So the problem is the Bangladeshis don't want them either. Some Bangladeshi officials said, well, we'll resettle them in islands in the Bay of Bengal, which means they would be hit by monsoons and typhoons every year and devastated. So that's not an option.
So where does it go?
That's the problem. If they are, in fact, allowed to go back under the UN High Commissioner for Refugees or some other auspices, supposing they go back, and supposing there's no violence, they still don't have any rights. They're still constrained in the areas in which they live. The schooling is bad. Health is bad. And if we impose sanctions on the military in order to try and alleviate the situation, will we get rid of those sanctions when they're going to go back to their home townships? I think not, because the human rights abuses will still be there, even if there's no physical violence at that particular time. So this is a very knotty issue. All of this means that Burma is a very significant player in this whole picture for China. And the U.S. basically has, I can't quite say retreated from Burma, but has not played as active a role as one might have hoped, even though we supply aid. And Thorson talked about increasing the aid to the Rohingya, which is a good thing. But it's limited.
Professor David Steinberg, a former distinguished professor of Asian studies at Georgetown University, thank you so much for your time and for your information. We greatly appreciate it.
My pleasure to be involved. Thank you.
These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on voanews.com. U.S. National Security Advisor says increasing possibility of war with North Korea. North's missile frustrates South Korea's Olympics preparations. China's ceramics capital struggles to adapt amid war on smog. World's largest lithium-ion battery is switched on in South Australia. A Vietnam war love affair, a baby, and 48 years later, a reunion. Well, you can find that online at voanews.com. Also on our Facebook page at VOA Asia. Visit. VOA Asia continues. As foreign investment enhances development in Myanmar, refugees and IDPs on the border areas are facing the harsh reality of diminished aid from international donors groups. On the Thai-Myanmar border, refugees in the camp talk about the difficulties of surviving there. Steve Sanford reports the reality of going home for the long-term refugees.
Here at the Malar refugee camp, it might seem to be an unlikely spot to travel to for food and education. But for more than 30 years, ethnic Karen families have been doing exactly that, as a long-standing civil war has left many seeking help on the Thai-Myanmar border. Now, as camp aid donors redirect funds to central Myanmar, things like rice supplies and qualified teachers have been reduced as budgets are slashed.
The students come from different refugee camps and come to study in Mela School for higher education. After the funding was reduced, it affected our school. We urgently need support for rice rations and school supplies. We are struggling to survive. Students and teachers are trying to find a solution.
Rations to feed 90,000 refugees in nine camps have shrunk since the 2010 election that saw a quasi-civilian government bring the appearance of democracy to Myanmar. It is illegal for refugees traveling outside the camps to earn extra income, and many are worried that promised jobs and homes in Myanmar will not exist.
We need to make sure the group that takes responsibility for the repatriation program will fully support and help the refugees, treating them as equal citizens. They must keep their word.
As repatriation plans continue, the Border Consortium, which provides most of the camp aid, is looking for solutions to fill the gaps for the most needy.
In the short term, it's more about looking for flexibility from donors in how their funds will be used, and that they're willing to work not only with the government of Myanmar, but also with the ethnic armed groups in terms of facilitating that return and supporting the reintegration with communities that are emerging from conflict as well.
As international development continues in government-controlled areas of Myanmar, those in the ethnic border areas hope that they won't be forgotten in the rush to do business. Steve Sanford reporting for VOA News from Mae Sot, Thailand.
Happening in Asia, the Japanese Prime Minister has announced Emperor Akihito will step down April 30, 2019, making it the first retirement in centuries for the imperial family, believed to be the world's oldest. Emperor Akihito is 83 and reported to have health issues. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you're with us today on VOA Asia. Thank you for listening. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis is on his way to Pakistan amid tense differences between Washington and Islamabad on the fight against terrorism. VOA correspondent Bill Gallo joins us from Kuwait as Mattis prepares to depart. Bill, this stop would seem to be the most important of the secretary's trip.
It's for sure sort of the highest profile visit of his trip. While he's in Islamabad, he'll meet with the country's army chief and the prime minister, and a major focus, the main focus, in fact, will be what Washington considers Islamabad's support or links to terrorist groups that actually attack coalition forces in Afghanistan. This has been an issue a long time for the United States. Over a decade, they've tried to get Pakistan to actually crack down on these groups and eliminate terrorist safe havens. It hasn't really worked, so it's not clear if tomorrow will do any better.
This has been a flashpoint, especially since President Trump announced his Afghan strategy and basically putting the finger toward Pakistan and saying that they were part of the problem.
Yeah, and not only that, I mean, it's nothing new for the U.S. to call out Pakistan and its relationship to militant groups. But one thing that really upset Pakistani authorities was in Trump's speech on Afghanistan, he called on India, Pakistan's arch rival, to do more in Afghanistan. And that sort of is a line that was crossed by Trump and really upset a lot of Pakistani officials. I'm sure that will come up tomorrow as well. The interesting thing is, coming into this meeting tomorrow, Secretary Mattis is really, really downplaying the tensions. He's being very optimistic. He said he's just going there to look for common ground. He didn't put any kind of ultimatum out. But interestingly, a couple months ago, in a address to lawmakers in Washington, Secretary Mattis actually said he was going to work with Pakistan, quote, one more time, and then he would do whatever is necessary to address Pakistan's relationship with militants.
So at least in this particular visit, it sounds like it's more trying to build on what we have in relations with Pakistan as opposed to trying to force them to do something.
Yeah, I mean, there is a working relationship there, there's no doubt. I mean, the U.S. has given billions of dollars to Pakistan in recent years. That aid has been reduced, but there is a lot of things to work on, even aside from the issue of militants. I'm sure that will come up, but we probably won't actually know the results of tomorrow's meeting for a few weeks at minimum, maybe even a few months. I think that Washington does want to give Islamabad a little bit of time to respond, and then we'll see what happens from there.
Right after that Afghan strategy was announced by President Trump, Pakistan did make an overture, if you will. They were instrumental in helping secure the release of an American couple that had been held by the Taliban for many years.
Right, and U.S. officials pointed to that as an example of, well, look, you know, we can work with Pakistan, and they are willing to help us there. But there was also some feeling, I think, from some analysts I talked to, the timing of that cooperation, of that mission he talked about, may have not been accidental either. That came not long after that Afghanistan speech in which Donald Trump called out Pakistan. So, you know, it's hard to tell which side is playing who, but there's definitely a game going on.
Bill Gallo traveling with Secretary Mattis, currently in Kuwait. Bill, thank you so much.
Thanks so much, Jim.
You're listening to VOA Asia.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Authorities in Bali are constantly monitoring Mount Agung's volcanic activities to make sure the people living nearby are safe. At least 43,000 residents were forced to evacuate Indonesia's resort city due to constant tremors and volcanic mud flows, which appear to be moving slowly. Your safe haven for news and features is VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, the Australian state of Victoria has become the first in the nation to legalize assisted dying. From Sydney, Phil Mercer tells us terminally ill patients opting for assisted dying must be at least 18 years old and have less than 6 months to live.
Victoria State Health Minister Jill Hennessy said the state parliament had considered what a good death looks like. The assisted suicide law is designed for patients with a terminal illness who are in severe pain. It will allow them to obtain a lethal drug within 10 days of asking to die. They must administer the drug themselves, but a doctor can give the lethal dose where an individual is physically unable to end their own life. Patients must be of sound mind and make three requests to specially trained doctors, while a special board will review all cases. Victoria State Premier Daniel Andrews has praised the landmark legislation.
The Parliament has just made history. This is a day of reform, a day of compassion, a day of giving control to those who are terminally ill and in the terminal phase of their life.
Critics of the landmark legislation said it was a recipe for elder abuse, while some doctors believe it will deny patients the right to receive palliative care, care for people who have serious illnesses. Associate Professor Mark Boffey, Director of Palliative Medicine at Melbourne St Vincent's Hospital, believes the new law is a bad move.
My biggest concern in the debate has been that I think people won't get an opportunity to access palliative care, that people will see the progression from illness and disease treatment, the next step will be assisted dying. They won't get the benefit of engagement and referral to palliative care.
The landmark legislation was approved after more than 100 hours of gruelling debate in the Victoria State Parliament. The law means terminally ill patients in Australia's second most populous state will have the right to request a lethal drug beginning in mid-2019. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Media reports say the Pentagon is looking at U.S. West Coast sites where additional defense systems can be installed following the North Korean threat of a strike. Some of the defenses would likely include terminal high-altitude area defense anti-ballistic missiles similar to those deployed in South Korea. You're up to date every day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the diamond industry has fallen on hard times lately. No pun intended. Sales of the traditional wedding gemstones are sluggish as millennials delay marriage, and expensive diamonds aren't the go-to proposal gemstone they once were. Another factor, as we hear from VOA's Kevin Enix, is that lab-grown diamonds are slowly moving into the market.
Diamonds have always been synonymous with love and commitment, but with a high price tag. Diamonds grown in a lab, though, are slowly making their way into the market. And this is
a pure gem. All the composition is exactly the same. It is a real diamond. What we've done is we've just taken what's happened in nature and just put it in a lab.
Industry watchers say lab diamonds are virtually identical to mined diamonds.
Diamonds have a definition, all right? They have a certain hardness. They have a certain chemical structure, they have a certain chemical composition. In that respect, laboratory-grown diamonds are really the same as mined diamonds.
The only real difference is that growing a diamond in a lab only takes a few months. Engineers take square diamond seeds, add high temperatures and a source of carbon, and over time, diamonds literally grow like crystals. The natural process takes thousands of years. In fact, one of the only ways to tell the difference is by the lack of impurities in the lab-grown diamonds.
I have a crystal, a diamond. I'm looking at it, and I see a peridot crystal, a green peridot crystal. I know right away this wasn't created in a machine. So the inclusions can really be very telling as to what the origin of that material is, and that's what our gemologists look for.
Lab-grown diamonds are slowly moving into the $14 billion a year diamond market.
Well, our consumer is, we're millennials. Anybody who's getting engaged are really buying the lab-grown diamonds. They also like the fact that of this environmental aspect of it, that it's grown in a greenhouse. There's less soil being moved. You know, we have a less carbon footprint.
and they cost about 30 to 40% less than mined diamonds. Market watchers say lab-grown diamonds are on track to take over 15% of the market by 2020. Kevin Enochs, VOA News.
Just about that time for the most prestigious awards for the past year's music. The Grammys are set to be handed out early next year, and we've learned who the nominees in the various categories are. As Top 20 Countdown host Ray McDonald joins us to tell us about this year's Grammy artists who are revealing new trends in the music industry.
Now tuned into the greatest. Turn the music up in the headphones.
It's going to be the 60th annual Grammy ceremony, and it really does seem to be emblematic of a new era. The Grammy Awards, of course, are when the music industry honors its own, and this is what sets them apart from other more commercially driven and fan-driven award ceremonies. This year's nominations were announced on Tuesday the 28th. Jay-Z leads the way with 8 nominations. He's already won 21 Grammys. Kendrick Lamar got 7. Bruno Mars has 6 nominations, while Childish Gambino, who's a fictional character, he's the creation of actor Donald Glover, scored 5 nominations. And the most nominated female artist is SZA, S-Z-A, who also has 5 nominations. In the Best New Artist race, Alicia Cara goes up against Khalid, who also has 5 nominations, Lil Uzi Vert, Julia Michaels, and SZA. And for the first time since 1999, no white male artist or group was nominated for Album of the Year. And of course, that's one of the big Grammy categories. And so what do we have happening here? Well, this summer, Nielsen noted that rap and hip-hop, for the first time, have surpassed rock as the most consumed music in the United States, and that's largely because of streaming. So streaming is becoming recognized by the Grammy voters. Streaming hits dominate nominations in all of the big 3 categories. That's record, song, and album of the year. Most people get their music from streaming now, and the Grammys are reflecting this. Pop musicians suffered in this year's crop of nominations. Ed Sheeran only got 2 pop nominations. Many people expected Shape of You to compete for Record of the Year, but it's not. Katy Perry was shut out of the nominations. She had a new album out this year, Witness. And so were some big pop producers like Jack Antonoff, Max Martin, and Jeff Basker. These are previous Grammy winners. They make many, many big hit singles. They're out of the loop. Taylor Swift is up for 2 secondary awards. Neither came from her Reputation album. Reputation dropped on November 10th. That's outside the Grammy eligibility period. So the makeup of the Recording Academy is changing. New members are coming aboard. Traditional views seem to be evolving along with the larger industry. It's going to be a very interesting Grammy ceremony, and it will take place on January 28th, 2018 in New York City. And even that is significant because it's the first time the Grammys are in the Big Apple since 2003.
Wow, a lot of changes, but a lot of reflection of what's happening in society as a whole.
Absolutely. You know, I think our popular culture and popular music is a very great reflection of the larger society. And we're definitely seeing things happening on the musical front with the Grammy nominations.
You can check out what's happening on the musical front each and every week with the Top 20 Countdown. Ray McDonald is your host. Catch him on VOA 1. Also follow him on Twitter.
Yeah, I have a lot of Grammy-related material on my Twitter feed right now. I'm at Ray on the Hits.
Thanks so much, Ray.
You got it, Jim.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You know, our program is found in many different places like iTunes and SoundCloud. We're also on the radio, like Media Biz Radio at Temasek Polytechnic in Singapore. Thanks to everyone there who's listening. And wherever you happen to be catching our program, we invite you to write to us. We want to hear from you. VOA Asia Facebook is a great place to get in touch with us. You can also send us an email, voaasia@voanews.com. We thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer John Ellison, managing editor Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and David Byrd on our VOA Asia team. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.